This week on the Dragzine Podcast, we talked to John Sears about X275 Racing, DXP235, Ultra Street, and what it takes to run a heads-up series. So, pull those belts tight. Get ready to put in the beans. The Dragzine Podcast starts now. Welcome, everybody, to the Dragzine Podcast. I'm your host, Senior Associate Editor Brian Wagner. And on the show this week, we have a really in-depth conversation with John Sears, the father of modern small-tire 275 racing, and kind of what goes into his thought processes and keeping the series going and, you know, the World Series of X and everything else. So it was kind of an interesting conversation to really hear where he's at with all this. So without further ado, let's get this drag racing party started. All right, my guest this week on the Dragzine Podcast is Mr. X275 Ultra DXP235 and all-around tech whiz, John Sears. What's up, John?
Hey, Brian. How are you today?
Doing good, doing good. Just recovering from the insanity of the 10K drag shootout that was going on in California. I was out there covering that along with Mr. Andrew Wolf, so still trying to get back to life as normal, I guess.
Yep, it's always tough coming off the road, especially when you guys are out there for an extended period of time. All the time zone changes, plus I'm sure y'all had some crazy hours and probably some beer drinking with a couple of those teams.
Yeah, the level of insanity that was going on there across the board was definitely intense, and the time changes, and I didn't partake in the beer drinking with the teams just for the simple fact that when I was out there, it was the second week, it was crunch time, and they were all more interested in getting their stuff done than going out and partying at the very end. The booze was broken out at the very end, but I was seeing myself out at the door at that point so I could get some sleep before I had to catch an early flight.
I got you. That's a killer going west. You lose so much time and everything else like that, but if I'm a betting man, and I am at times, I would probably go to say that this year's deal is going to be just as much fun, if not more so, than last year's deal.
Oh, it's going to be insane. The level of cars being built is just it's different than last year. The level of fabrication that went into the cars is amazing. Yeah, I can't reveal too much, but I can definitely say that this year's show is the builds are going to be insane, and I'm not scheduled to cover the actual racing portion of it this year, but I might actually take personal time to go to No Mercy just to see how all this unfolds live. It's going to be that insane.
Yeah, I think that's going to be epic. We saw those guys swapping parts and talking trash and whatnot at Shakedown last year. I thought that was really cool to get a chance to see what it was all about, especially after all the hype on social media and everything. And of course, knowing quite a few of those guys, that always kind of, see what Big Daddy's up to and see what Lyle and all those guys are up to, and Eric Kenward and all those guys that were involved. It's just pretty cool to watch some of the builds that came out of the short-term turnaround time. You look at some of that stuff, and it was almost Mad Max-like.
Oh, yeah. With what these guys did in the time frame, the level of fabrication that each of these teams put into the cars, chassis-wise, and how they approached the drive lines and everything, is definitely going to be really interesting this year for people to kind of see how this went about it. It was, four very different takes on how to build a car in 10 days.
Right. I'm sure with the very talent that you had there, everybody coming at it probably from multiple different directions to get to the same result.
Oh, yeah. It was definitely interesting to see the thought processes and how it all came together. And, seeing how it's all going to come together at No Mercy is going to be interesting. And that'll be your second or third trip there for this year. The last one was for the World Series of X275, which – watching that on the live pay-per-view was just as riveting as watching Radio versus the World, because it turned into another version of a home run derby, except on, smaller tires.
It certainly did. I can't say enough about the opportunity that Duck gave these guys to go down there and race for that kind of money. And of course, a stellar amount of money in the second chance race as well. You know, so when you're looking at $50,000 to win, biggest payout in X275 history, probably the biggest payout in any 275 class in history, bar none. And the results speak for themselves. These guys were getting after it hard. And to be included in that picture with the 16 qualifiers from the World Series of X was an honor. I was proud to be standing there with those guys because I know the level of effort each and every one of them and their teams put into to getting to that point. And that's not to throw shade on any of the guys that didn't break into the 16, because there were teams that were on the outside of the 16 that any one of them could have broke in and got there. It just happened to be luck of the draw and timing for a lot of these guys to put their passes together. How the alignment of the stars and the sun and the moon all tend to work sometimes in your favor and sometimes it doesn't. So it was great to see all these guys come out and support. I think we had like 80 or 90 cars there or something like that. It was overwhelming.
Oh, it was funny watching people try to talk about the betting line on what the bump would be. And, you know, we were all thinking it'd be, you know, the bump would be, you know, low 440s maybe. And then everything changed quickly.
It changed rapidly. I think I had it at like a 37 or something like that is where I thought it was going to be, 36, 37. I figured some guys would step up their game a little bit and get after a little bit harder. And sure enough, man, a lot of them got after it and the numbers on the board. And then going back, if you look like between 16 and 40, I think it was, I think every one of those guys were all in the 30s. And there were people we were having to go out multiple places and go to mile an hour in order to get, you know, an idea of where to put them on the ladder. You know, when the CompuLink was setting up, you're looking at it and you're going, man, well, this guy ran a 435 and this guy ran a 435 and they both ran a 435 with a 4, you know, so, you know, we start looking at mile an hour and everything else and let CompuLink do its thing to figure that out. It was just amazing to see how they were just stacked one on top of the other within thousands.
It was almost like pro stock with power adders, quite literally, with how that shook out.
Yeah, you gotta look at you know, the centrifugal superchargers. We had root superchargers. We had, you know, turbos. We had big turbos. We had smaller turbos. You know, between 88 and 85. You know, I think we even had a mod motor in there, and you know, I mean, it was just all around looking at what everybody did and how close the numbers were. I was just amazed. Oh. And the weather couldn't have been any better for us.
Don't forget that you also had a diesel powered vehicle and a 2JZ in there as well.
Yeah, I was gonna go to that next because I'm actually on my way to Emerald Coast to see Ryan and we're running X275 and Ultra Street down there at Mayhem on the Coast right now. But that was fitting to see a team like Titan come out, and they did their homework beforehand. You know, we've had, you know, inline six in the rules forever and a day, because I've always been a part of Jason Miller's deal at World Cup since I moved to the Virginia, Maryland area. And just to see what those import guys would do, I always wanted them to line up with the X275 guys. And we got to see the opportunity with the Titan car. And then, you know, you throw a diesel, you know, Chevy 2 into the mix. You know, it just sort of really, really rounded out the field, barring the small block nitrous cars, which I know a couple of those guys struggled with some numbers and stuff like that to get them in the field. But, man, had we been able to get a small block nitrous car in there, every combo would have been represented, I believe, at that point within the 16.
And that's just wild, especially, you know, with the last two cars mentioned, with Ryan's car. I remember I shot a feature when he had his black truck, and he told me that he was going to he had some ideas on what he was going to do with the driveline out of that truck. And then he purchased Mickey Tessner's Nova, which is, you know, another car shot for a feature, which is a work of art. And then he combined those two, and people kind of giggled at first. And, you know, I was trying to explain to people, don't sleep on these guys. When they get this car figured out, it's going to be nasty. And they've been chipping away and chipping away at it. And then when they lit the board with that 20-something, I mean, people shouldn't be shocked at that at all.
No, absolutely not. And the thing is, you know, we've worked with Brian, you know, to get the nitrous jetting where it needs to be, and you know, to keep the thing alive, because, you know, they don't turn a lot of RPM to get where they need to be. But the amount of torque and horsepower that thing is putting out is ridiculous. So I'm sure at some point he probably questioned himself too with parts and materials and things that he was using to the extreme levels that he was. And now with a billet piece in there, you know, 88 millimeter turbo and nitrous, it just proves that diesel can be competitive in the class. And it's just, to me, it's shocking to see, you know, somebody put forth that kind of effort to make a combination that nobody thought would ever be competitive in the class up at the front, right? I mean, you look at what he did at World Series of X, and to jump into that 16-car Shark Tank is pretty damn impressive.
Oh, and that car could most definitely go rounds too. That's the other thing that's scary about it, is he gets that, you know, the functionality of it lined out a little bit more. That thing could almost go on repeat, and that could spell trouble for a lot of people.
Absolutely, and the thing is, I say to anybody that may offer a complaint or a disagreement of that particular car or that combination in the class, I say build one. And show everybody how easy it is to run a diesel in X275. I'm betting they won't.
Oh, they'll run from that like it's on fire. And, you know, I think the guys in Radio Versus the World better not laugh too loud, because if Ryan decides he wants to drop that into a ultralight Pro Mod chassis, you know that there's going to be a lot of tears flowing when he gets that working.
I definitely think it could happen. I think the particular combination that sits between the frame rails of that Chevy 2 has proven that at 3,400 pounds, it's more than capable of going 420s. What would it do at, let's say, 2,700 pounds?
That would be phenomenal to watch with that car, for sure.
Yep. I think that right there would really... you know, he's sort of knocked people's socks off with the current combination in X. And if he was to do something similar in Radio Versus the World, as far as, you know, that high level of performance, man, that guy could pretty much write his own ticket anywhere he went.
Oh, and it's the same thing with the Titan car. Those guys have been around, people don't realize, for a very long time, going fast in different classes. And when I saw that car roll up, and you see people on the internet that like to poke fun, oh, it's an import, I'm like, you don't want to poke that bear, because if it swipes back, it's going to hurt you.
Right. And those guys are at a level where our top tier X275 teams are, right? They're rolling in stackers and toters and big rigs, and there's a team of guys to work on the car and you know, most cases. And Titan has proven time and time again that when they do come out and they do enter a class, it's not to be on the outside looking in. It's to be right in the middle of things and out front often.
I think what people need to, that would blow their minds if they really think about it, is I'm pretty sure that's the first official X275 race they ever ran.
That's correct.
And they stuck that car in arguably the gnarliest X275 field ever on their first try.
Exactly. That just shows that where we currently have the weight for that program, it's pretty close to being, where it needs to be in order for that, you know, two JZ turbo combination to be competitive. And I look at that much as I look at Ryan's field. It's so easy, and these guys, people think that they've been given something or handed something on a silver platter. If it's that easy, do it yourself and let me know the level of effort it's going to take. And I guarantee you won't like it.
Yeah, and speaking of people complaining about rules and how things were laid out, then you have the guys that won the Bruder Brothers who probably have given you more gray hairs than any other racer in the universe, right?
Yeah, I you know, those guys race so damn hard, man, and they put so much effort in. And it often seems as if we're at odds. We both want what's best for the class. They want to be out front. So that's best for them, and that's best for their program. And I want, you know, large fields and parity and competitive racing. So oftentimes, you know, those things come to some sort of head, and we have to rein people back in, or we have to lighten other people up, and there's some disagreements and whatnot. But at the end of the day, you know, we all try to maintain, you know, a professional attitude about things, and they have a job, and their job is to go fast, and I have a job, and mine is to keep parity and keep the fields full and keep people interested in coming to race at 75.
Yeah, and I think that totally outlines what's going on there is because, you know, those guys work super, super hard at what they do, and they are very, very drag racing savvy, and it tests you and other rule makers that classes they get involved in, because other people might look at a combo and be like, that'll never work, this will never work, and they somehow just have this savant way of finding a way to make something work that other people just can't make go fast.
Right. And once they make it go fast, you'll look that there's a bit of a domino effect behind them with people running the same combination, where they go, well, if those guys can figure it out and they can go that fast with that combo, I'm going to scratch harder on mine to see if I can't, you know, get it going. Because there's not a team in X275 that loads their car in the box at the end of the weekend and figures, well, that's good enough. Each and every one of these teams bust their ass to make sure that they put the very best effort forward every time they line up with one of their competitors. And every one of them works hard. Every one of them spends a ton of money to be a part of this thing. And it humbles me to no end to know the level of effort these guys go to, each and every one of them, to be a part of this program.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it comes back to, you know, some people that, you know, I call them the internet experts, just don't realize what goes into making a heads-up car fast. You know, the 1 year with Ray Litz, we spent 3 out of 4 weeks, weekends a month, racing somewhere, trying to get a handle on that car and learn and learn and learn. And ultimately it worked out and we started winning because it took time at the track to figure something out. And exactly what you said, the second you load it up in the box, that just means you're not going to be hot, sweaty, dirty, or cold anymore. Now you got to go home and, you know, Ray had to work on the laptop and look at everything to find out the missing keys that he's, you know, was missing in the tune. And that's the same thing that, you know, teams like the Bruder Brothers do, it just except at a ultra high level.
Right, right. And one of the benefits for them is they tune multiple cars, so they're able to get multiple looks at different combinations and chip away from different directions, often leading to not only their customers performing well, but of course their car, you know, performing as well as it did, particularly at the World Series of X, because what they did was nothing short of amazing, running the numbers that they ran. You know, we had such a high level of tech there that guys were, you know, coming to get us when they were turning bolts on almost any part of the car to let us know, hey, look, we're pulling this off, or we're doing this, or we're doing that. You know, we want you guys here. You know, we locked in data on their combinations and serial numbers for their blowers and turbos. you know, we found out some guys had a head gasket issue, so they took their cylinder head off. Well, we took that opportunity to check valve angle and to do bore stroke measurements. And, you know, we pumped engines and cabled turbochargers and superchargers, and locked them in with hard seals that were stainless cable with their own individual serial number on them, and those were locked in. So there's nobody at the end of that weekend that could say for Radio Versus the World or X275 that things weren't checked at the highest level. And there was an extremely high level of accountability. And if you look at the folks that were doing tech, you know, let's just say there were five of us there, between myself, Dennis Hampton Jr., Lonnie Grimm, Lonnie Pepelow, and Roger Conley. So that's five guys, right? Let's just say we average 20 years of experience each. That's 100 years of experience, looking over the parts and looking over the cars and making sure things are 100% legitimate. And I go back to the racers and their level of openness for us each time we came to, you know, do something as simple as a fuel sample check. And we were changing when we were doing those. We were checking them in the pits. We checked them in the lanes before they ran, and then we checked them after they crossed the scales as well. We never gave them the same look twice, you know, to kind of keep them on their toes. And I think it paid off in the end because, as you saw, you know, Sunday and Monday morning online, there was nobody bitching about anybody getting through tech with any kind of, you know, sideways stuff, so to speak.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That was the one thing, I guess, that in the back of my mind, I was personally wondering how all that was going to go because, you know, racers like to find that gray area and live in it. And then seeing all the procedures that were going to be put into place and then seeing, you know, being through tech that both you and Lonnie have put through on a car, I know that it's a NHRA white glove thorough. So I knew someone would have to work really hard to sneak something by. And apparently no one either tried or they put some Herculean effort into it.
No, there was enough word of mouth going out, you know, about the level of tech that we were doing. And hats off to Donald for stepping up and bringing some extra guys in and doing what needed to be done, you know, to make this what it was. Because, you know, when you get that kind of money on the line, people are prone to doing some things that they probably shouldn't or wouldn't normally do. And we didn't find anything like that. So, like I said, we put the word out, you know, a month, 3 weeks, 2 weeks out, and we just kept beating on the drum that everything was going to be checked, and it was going to be checked at a new level that they'd never been exposed to before. To be ready with it, come to tech with tools. If you're asked to pull something apart and you don't want to, then that particular part or that component will be disqualified from competition, and you're going to have to find something that you do feel like us taking apart and measuring and doing what we have to do to make sure everything's legit.
It kind of reminds me of a few years ago when Scott Blomquist got popped at Eldora crossing the scales too light and lost like $50,000 or $100,000 at the end of that race. And that's, you know, that's a nightmare scenario for any racer. And the joke after the fact was he made sure his car was heavy when he crossed the scale. So I'm sure a few of the racers kind of had that in the back of their minds that they didn't want to be that guy that's forever known for being the one that boofed on the big payday because they decided to try to sneak one by.
Oh, for sure. But you got to understand, these guys, you know, asked multiple times, you know, when the scales would be open, when they could. They were literally weighing their cars, sometimes dragging them down there right before they went to the lanes, just to make sure that with, you know, a loss of fuel or there were nitrous car fuel and nitrous combined, they'd still be able to cross the scales because nobody wanted to make that kind of mistake.
Oh, for sure. That'd be, you know, so catastrophic. And after all that was said and done and, you know, X was put on the stage at this kind of level, do you think that that now really sets the tone as X being probably one of the most technically challenging and, you know, difficult classes for racers to, you know, try to throw their hat into?
You know, sometimes simple is better, right? That old keep it simple, stupid thing. And I tend to look at the rules, and of course, Donald always gives me grief, you know, and it's like a stack of encyclopedias you got over there for rules, and how many pages are they this year, and this, that, and the other. You know, the rules were derived from questions and people trying to push gray areas or areas that weren't described correctly in the rules to keep people from doing certain things and to keep cars from going too outside the line. And we've somewhat simplified them over the years. They got kind of worried probably from four or five, six years ago. And then this year, working with the NMRA and NMCA folks, first Lonnie and then Roger, we looked at the rules and we tried to pare everything down to get it a little easier to read. And I think even next year, we're going to go probably to a newer level of simplicity to try to nail this thing down and make it even more simple than it has been in the past.
Do you think with those performances that were seen at, you know, the World Series, which was pretty much ideal, 110% perfect, do you think anybody's going to be able to replicate that this year? Or is that just going to be kind of a one-time deal? Or now that they have the data, it's, you know, it's on tap.
Right. Well, you know how it was in Radio versus the World, right? Nobody was running what they ran. And then all of a sudden, you know, they broke through that barrier. And then they had all year to continue getting data and running what they ran. Sometimes it's weather and track dependent. Sometimes it's just the amount of data somebody has that allows them to make that next step. It took a good while after the first Sweet 16 for those guys to kind of replicate and duplicate what they had accomplished at that event through the racing year. Oh. Unlike Radio vs. the World, X guys went out, and I think the Brooders went like a 23, 24, 25. Kenny Hubbard went a 25 at Tyler's race in Bowling Green during qualifying. And I think those guys qualified 1-2 there. So they certainly learned something, and both combinations were carrying a little more weight. The Brewers were carrying 75 more, and Kenny was carrying 50 more than what they had at the World Series of X. So it just shows that that combination makes a ton of power is capable of running at the front regardless of where the weight currently sits.
You know, the key is data. That's, you know, something that Kevin Rivenbark talked about, and every heads-up racer will tell you that data is what makes the world go round, and it kind of is the what you need to make sure that you're making the level of power you need to make and putting it down, too, the power management side of it.
Right. Right. That is so key and critical, right? Because you can have all the data in the world, but if you don't know how to apply it mechanically to the car, it's not going to do you much good, right?
Oh, no. It's pointless. You know, that's kind of what I guess attracts some people to no prep, is it makes, you know, a little bit more of an even playing field. But even then, you see a lot of really smart guys like the Bruder brothers kind of invading that territory and, you know, figuring it out real quick how to make those cars go fast.
Right, right. They have made their presence known over there and have impacted that group of racers in the no prep scene significantly. And I think it's probably only a matter of time before you see those guys sitting in the winner's circle over there as well.
Yeah, you know, you've seen, you know, Ferris and Mills already go over there and shake a lot of cages, and a lot of those teams just don't know how to react to those guys because they figured it out quickly, and they're making up a lot of ground fast.
Right, right.
You know,
that's another smart team that's out there, right? That's another group of guys that are very intelligent and go about what they do very professionally.
Yeah, it's definitely not a jump on the keyboard and, you know, start moving values around to see how fast this thing can go. They do a, you know, graduate level analysis of data to figure out where their next move's going to be.
Right, right. It's all done with a purpose, and that's to make that car go quicker down the track.
Yeah, it's very interesting to watch any of these teams across the board, how they make adjustments in any heads-up class and the thought process that goes behind it, all the variables that are weighed as they go through and do it.
Yeah, you know, the whole shock and converter technology stuff comes into to huge account, right? When you're dealing with the both the prep and the no prep stuff, you know, the radial stuff is where a lot of the shock guys just really shine in their ability to apply and then hold that power as the car's going down the track. People like Mark Venter and his group over there, those guys have just got a really good handle on what needs to be done. And Mark's ability to read data and look beyond what the shocks are doing and look into the power management side with what the converter's doing and how the boost controller's doing and where the engine's happiest and where the shift points are and the recovery. You know, he's able to look at that and you know, tie that up with a shock package that just makes some of his stuff unbeatable.
Oh, yeah, it's truly amazing to see the strides that, you know, he's kind of helped make in getting shocks to behave how they need to with a radial tire and kind of part of that big technological edge that's pushed these cars along, you know, with the converter technology and the electronics. But, you know, it all comes down to what those shocks and how that power gets put down. And it's kind of crazy to see some of these cars and the separation that happens from those shocks that they've kind of been able to coax out of them that stick that power down.
Right, right. You get some of that chassis separation, right, to plant the tire. But then, you know, the valving that goes into, you know, the compression side of things to hold that tire to keep it from bouncing back off the track is pretty freaking amazing. Considering, you know, not all tracks are as glass smooth as others, and there's little ripples and bumps and things out there that these cars hit. And, you know, you can see on the shot graphs where those things are on the track. And, you know, you can take power away at certain points to allow the tire to stay hooked up, and it's pretty amazing to see that happen.
Oh, yeah, you go through and look at the data with, like, some of the stuff that Shannon Davis has with that VPS and everything else, and, you know, it tells you where there's big bumps in the track down to, like, the thousandth of an inch. It's, you know, it's insane to watch how all that comes together, and, you know, it's amazing to see how far that the data level in heads-up racing has come. It's almost to like a Formula One level with how everything's combed over and looked at, but you don't have a team of people doing it. Usually it's just one tuner behind a keyboard or the racer himself.
Right, right. It's pretty amazing. You know, you look at that, you look at all the technology and the data that's available for a lot of these guys, but you go to some of the smaller teams or some of the teams that aren't quite as well known as some of these that are out there that don't have that stuff available to them, and they're still making it work. They're still going down the track and they're still fast.
Oh.
And that is very impressive.
Oh, it's like, you know, with ultra street cars these days, you know, that has turned into a pretty brutal class just because of the level of competitiveness that's in there with what those drivers, you know, they got to figure out how to make more with less. And, you know, there's a lot of interesting combinations in there, what racers are able to do.
Yeah, that is a tough nut to crack over there. We've got some really diverse teams that are currently racing in class, and you've got a great program up at Cecil County that races every month, and Victor and the crew at Bradenton have a great crew that runs Ultra Street down there, not only at their, you know, U.S. Street Nationals, but also at the Snowbirds, and then they have their Heads Up Madness series, and then Ozzie and Wade to Ultra a couple times if you're there. And, you know, Ultra's starting to grow and starting to to look as a pretty good alternative for some folks over an X275, just because of the fact that the pace of the technology, the pace of the EVs has gotten to the point where it's quite unruly as I see it from the rulemaker standpoint. But we try to do our best to keep that going. You have to temper your enthusiasm as far as parity is concerned with enthusiasm for keeping people focused on the class as they make, you know, new records and new strides in the class to go faster and to go quicker and to do new things, because otherwise it'll get stagnant and people won't want to watch. We might as well index race at that point.
Oh, yeah. And it's Extreme Street in the NMCA that's kind of patterned after Ultra Street, right?
Yeah, so they had their own thing going there, and a lot of the guys were crossing over, and there was some pretty significant weight swings that they made. So when the discussion was made with Street Outlaw and X275 coming together, we also brought Extreme Street and Ultra Street together, and I think this year it's going to be one of those things where we need to go back and we need to look at the positives, and then we need to go back and look and see where we need to tidy up some things. Because the big effort on our part was to decrease the level of activity for Ultra Street racers into Extreme Street and X275 racers into Street Outlaw. And we haven't quite seen the numbers to push both those classes to, full 16-car fields at each one of the NMCA and NMRA events. We'll go back and, bring our heads together. Roger and I, and I'm sure Raleigh will have some wonderful input for us to figure out what direction we need to go in. But, I've sort of saddled my cart to those guys. And it really helps me share the load where I'm not completely – bearing the entire load of the X275, Ultra Street, and the 35 rules all in one. Because Ultra Street, with our monthly program at Cecil, there's a couple of guys up there that they really shine and they do well. And people with essentially those same combinations in other locations just aren't seeing the same success. So I'm trying to balance, the countrywide series, and also appease the monthly guys at the Cecil thing, the Cecil Streetcar Shootout on Saturdays, just so we can keep things alive and keep 275 going on the East Coast. It's Ultra 275 there. It's under their own moniker, but I pretty much run those rules and work with Dave O'Donnell and Jim there. So, we're trying to get everybody on the same page. We're trying to get all the racers on the same page. I think in the end, it'll give everybody an opportunity not to have to make big swing weight or changes to their cars to compete at multiple venues.
Well, yeah, it's nice to have that capability to go to multiple different events and run under the same rules, especially, if you're like an X car that might not necessarily have a real big scene locally, being able to, if you want to go tour with the NMCA and even the NMRA, it's nice to have that kind of option as well. And some racers, they want to chase a championship, and that'll give them another opportunity to do it as well.
Right. I mean, we've got, three championships, on the line, in X275 Ultra and DXP this year with our great sponsors, Neil Chance and Precision and Vortec over with Ultra Street and Haltech at DXP. So, each one of those are going to be paid out at PRI, and we'll see three new champions crowned, but then also NMCA will have their Street Outlaw and their Extreme Street, and NMRA will have Street Outlaw and I believe Renegade. Essentially Ultra crossover for NMRA. So, I mean, that's what, 9 opportunities to put a crown on your head. Pretty good.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And then, speaking of DXP 235, That's an interesting class because we used to race something here locally in Ohio along those lines, the MX-235, and it's kind of wild to see that if you go through and read those rules, they're brutally simple yet pretty restrictive on what you can do as far as with the car and the power adders.
Right. That's the beauty of it is with no boost controller and no nitrous controller, and a smaller tire, it really makes the racers step outside their comfort zone and get into some areas that they probably wouldn't be thinking about tuning wise. And I think it's about as entry level as it gets. And learning our lessons. And some very hard lessons in X275 and Ultra Street over the years. You tend to look at, how things were done and how we continue to do things and what can we do with BXP to make it better and to do things a little bit differently, to keep that more entry level and more appealing to somebody that just doesn't have the funds or the ability to run down into the 470s and 460s like Ultra does. The best thing that we can do probably is keep BXP out of the 4 second zone. And I think one of the ways to do that is to look at the mistakes I made with X and Ultra and not make those over again. I often add weight to combos that are too fast, right? And then thereby pushing them up against 33, 34, 3,450 pound marks, which I feel is a little bit too heavy. And at that point right there, if I've got to put that much weight on a combination, it might be better just to get rid of that combination out of the rule set, right? That way it's gone and I no longer have to worry about it. And the stuff that's a little bit lighter and a little bit more manageable at that point, if it needs it, we've got some room to add weight without going over and crushing people,
Oh yeah, that's a great example of something similar to that is the factory showdown cars. That's one of the things that I talked with Leah Pritchett about is that those cars, the Mopars, are up against the weight limit for their chassis, and it kind of has put the NHRA almost in a box with how they can try to draw some parity in that class because some very, very smart people got involved with that class, and all of a sudden it kind of exploded. And the same thing can be said about X275 Ultra Street, and seeing how that movie ended twice, essentially twice now, you're kind of in a, like you said, in a box with what you're trying to do with DXP 235.
Right. So oftentimes when combos can't compete, right, we take weight off them to allow them a lighter weight and the ability to move that mass a little bit better with the power they're capable of making. And that works to some extent, but you get to a point like we currently are with the nitrous small block cars in X, and man, if I ever give those guys another weight break, I'm liable to get shot. I mean, I'm kidding about that, of course, but there's nowhere for those guys to go, right? So at that point right there, we've got such a spread between, a 3,200 pound combo and a 2,400 pound combo. That's 800 pounds. Right. So at what point do you just say, the combination that's sitting out there at 3,200 pounds is too heavy, and the combination at 2,400 pounds is too light? And how do we find common ground to close that gap? And I think that the toothpaste is sort of out of the tube in X. I think Ultra is still manageable, but learning from that particular scenarios. I think we can take BXP and look at some of the stuff like some of the blower stuff that's just too big and too fast for the class, and essentially eliminate it and take it off the table for folks to use. And that way, we're not pushing the heaviest car, out front, right? That even though it's 3,400 pounds or 3,250 or 3,300. And it's still capable of running out front. That probably tells me that that particular power adder is too much for the class and what we want to achieve horsepower wise, right?
Oh, yeah.
So, that's a different way of looking at it. So for those folks out there that, you know, oh, we're still going to make the same mistakes in PHP that we made in the other class, believe me, that is not my intention. That is not the path we want to travel. We're going to try to do something different. We're going to try to really keep a handle on this. My skin is calloused and fairly thick after going through X and Ultra. So whatever you guys in DXP want to yell at me about, it's okay, because I'm going to do things a little bit differently and hopefully keep this thing in check.
Well, it puts you in an interesting position as a rules maker, because not only are you fighting mechanical items that manufacturers produce, you're fighting with the racers essentially, because, you know, we're like goldfish. We'll eat, you know, goldfish eats till it almost dies. Racers will go as fast as they possibly can without, you know, being checked. And, you know, with these combos, racers just want to go fast. That's it. You know, it's not just a win. It's just the fact that they did it. And that kind of makes you know, building these combos difficult, because, you know, they understand there needs to be rules, but they just want to be like Ricky Bobby and go fast.
Right. I mean, that's why we got into this, right? Because we all love going fast, and we all love racing, and we love the competition, and we don't want to be constrained, right? This is quote unquote outlaw racing, right? So, you know, it should be 10 rules. And number 10 should be, you know, if you can't run with a big dog, stay on the porch. Well, that sounds all well and good, but when you're going to events and there's, you know, six cars or there's four cars in a class, and it's due to the rules or it's due to the costs and things of that nature there, you've got to do some things to make sure that you put some cars in the lanes. Because when you've got a decent amount of cars in the lanes, that means you've got butts in the seat. And regardless of where people stand on it, this is a business and people are in it to make money. Nothing's free in this world. So you've got to do the very best you can and get those butts in the seats and keep those lights on, right?
Oh, absolutely. And like you said, that's what, you know, trying to balance all of that together is such a challenge across the board. You know, it's not like Nitro racing where, you know, there's a certain amount of rules, but at the same time it's kind of almost unlimited to the point where they're limited by physics at this point in budget, whereas with small tire racing, you know, you got to keep these guys in check with budget, because otherwise they'll find ways to go fast and go broke doing it.
Right. I mean, we all know there's always, you know, there's always teams in heads up racing that we'll see come out, and man, they are just bulletproof and right to the front of the pack. And 2 years later, you never hear from those guys again. And that's because the cost of doing business at this level is extremely high. And if you don't have the financial wherewithal, or you do, but you just don't have the stomach for spending that amount of money, sometimes it's best just to, you know, be comfortable with where you wind up, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And then you get into the whole, you know, bracket racers think we're stupid for heads-up racing, and heads-up racers don't like bracket racers for, you know, they think what they do is dumb. And it's funny when you see the roles reversed. You know, there's a lot of heads up guys, if they tried to go bracket racing, they get their feelings hurt real quick, because those guys they're surgeons on the starting line and at the top end. It's not about, you know, carpet bombing horsepower.
Right. And that's one of the things that with X being as close as it is these days, and Ultra as well, you know, if I remember correctly, at World Series of X, there was five or six pairings that were won by hole shots. Because things are that close, you have to be up on the wheel and you have to be ready to go. If you breathe wrong, you're liable to find yourself on the trailer next round, you know?
Oh, yeah, there's been times where the slightest bobble is going to cost you. You have to be, you know, it's the days of being able to just steamroll people are gone, especially at that level where all 16 cars could probably beat each other at any one point.
Yep, exactly. And you know, back to your bracket racing. You know, comment. And who the hell hits the brakes before the finish line? You know, that's That's unheard of. That's the biggest problem heads up racers have. They only know how to drive through the finish line. They don't know how to tap the brakes before the finish line. A breakout, man, there's no such thing as a breakout or a buyback in a heads up race.
Oh yeah, it's totally different worlds, and I've really started to kind of personally, with you know what I can afford to race is bracket index style cars, and starting to follow what a lot of these guys do at the highest level of bracket racing, and it's mind blowing with how just accurate these guys are. You know, cutting a 001 light, running within a 1/10,000th of your dial in and losing. That's just gut-wrenching.
Right. It is. It's just as bad as losing on a hole shot, or you know, losing by 10,000ths, you know, in a heads up race. It's what those guys do. It's what they're good at. And the ones that are really good at it, man, there is no margin for error with what they do.
Oh yeah, those guys are just absolute, you know, crack shots at what they do across the board, knowing what their cars can do, how to, you know, drive both ends of the track. It's absolutely phenomenal to watch. And on the flip side, then it's phenomenal to watch, you know, a heads up team that's able to tame a, you know, a 4,000 horsepower car and just ride that bucking Bronco down the track while cutting, you know, a good light. Is, you know, there's a lot going on there as well.
Yep, there is. It's pretty amazing to watch the level of consistency out of some of these teams. You know, you said something about index racing as well. And I remember, you know, checking results for Orska back in the day, you know, with the 6.0 and 7.0 classes, and, you know, going down 6 or 7 spots just to find somebody that didn't run a 7.01 or a 7.02 or a 7.0 flat. I mean, those guys were they were money. You know, in 6.0 and 7.0 back then, it was really, really amazing to see the ladders and the qualifying sheets for those classes, because those guys were dead on. And, you know, anywhere in the country on any given weekend, there's bracket racers out there doing their thing, right?
Oh yeah, it's, you know, bracket racing is one of those things that, you know, some people may refer it to as class filler, which to a certain point it helps keep a heads up racing program going, but at the same time, that's like your feeder program for all your heads up stuff, because there might be some of those guys that sit back and watch, man, I want to do that someday. So it's important to keep as many people involved in racing as possible at any level.
Yep. And that's, you know, that's always been the goal, right? As you know, my racing has somewhat subsided. We haven't raced as often as we would like. You know, we started with nitrous small block cars and doing some index racing and doing some heads up racing. That's actually how X275 came about, right? Small block nitrous car can't run against a twin turbo car in a quarter mile, so that's why we reduced it to 1/8 and whatnot. But you know, looking back at all that, my whole goal is just to keep people going to the track, right? Keep tracks open, keep people interested in drag racing, because at that point right there, you know, if I've got nowhere to take my own car to go drag racing because the tracks have all closed up, what good is the car, right? I mean, I'm not a buff and polish show car guy, hanging out, you know, telling people what I used to do is probably, you know, not one of my favorite things to do. I'd rather go out and do rather than talk about what we used to do.
Oh yeah, that's, you know, the crux of the issues. You know, we're spoiled here in Ohio that, you know, I've got 6 or 8 tracks I could go to that were within a, you know, 3-hour tow. And, you know, you go to the place where drag racing started in California, and you know, drag strips are as rare as hen's teeth these days.
It is. It's ridiculous how dried up the scene is out there in California as far as the amount of tracks available, considering that's the birthplace of the sport. You know, how did that happen? Why did that happen? And how can we keep it from happening in the rest of the country? And, you know, all these promoters that are out there putting on these great events and everything else like that, they need to be supported. And we need to put butts in the seats, and we need to put cars in the lanes to keep our sport alive. And you know, I know junior dragsters were the rage to keep the interest up for younger generation coming up and wanting to drag race. And I applaud NHRA's efforts and all the folks that are involved in junior drag racing, you know, keeping the sport alive through the youth. And I look at Heads Up, and I look at the guys that we race with, and, you know, we've been doing this Heads Up thing for quite a while now. All of us are getting older, and I want to know who's coming behind us. And there's a lot of younger guys that are all starting to step up, whether it be from like a manufacturer's standpoint, with guys like Doug Cook at Motion, or, you know, you got Victor down in Bradenton, and now Troy Perez Jr. Innovative is starting his stuff down there with the Florida No Time program and Florida Heads Up Association and things of that nature there. I got my good friend JB, who's got this no clock small block thing working. So that class is just so on point. I'm so glad to see these guys come out and be a part of things. And they're younger than me, still have passion, still have enthusiasm for what they do and what we all do, because that means the sport is healthy and it's alive. If you see Zach and Seth Buff and those guys carrying the torch that Ronnie has handed off to them down at Shadyside, it's a wonderful thing, man. Those guys love drag racing. They love being a part of it. So I think we need to continue to cultivate, guys that are in their gals in their teens, 20s, and 30s, and keep them interested. So all us old heads have a place to go sit in the bleachers and talk about what we used to do, right?
Oh yeah, definitely. It's the old saying, you know, never trust an old man in a young man's game. You know, that could be definitely true with drag racing to a certain point, because, you know, those of us that have been around for a while in different capacities understand that, you know, that it's not the passion that dies, it's the physical energy level, and having those younger people that want to push the boundaries and keep it going. You know, that's kind of where the torch needs to be passed. They need to be encouraged to keep that going.
Absolutely.
Because as much as I love going to the track, you know, the days of wanting to be up till 3 o'clock in the morning swapping transmissions on the pavement, that loses its fun after a while.
That it does. That's why all the old guys with the money have lifts and crews, right?
Oh yeah.
So they can sit in the shade and sip iced tea and ask him if the car's ready yet.
Delegation. It's a good
That's right.
Good leadership sign. You know, how's it going over there?
It is. Hey, you guys, let me know when the car's ready. I'll get my driving suit on.
Yeah, asking them, you know, how they want the burgers done and whatnot. You know, you got to pay your dues and work your way up through it.
Exactly. I used to teach my youngest son all the time. He would fly in from college, and you know, we would have the car all ready, you know, for him when he came home during the summer from college. And I was like, man, he's got kind of like this rock star status thing. You fly in, the car's ready, you get the race, you know, you go do this and that, and then you fly home. I said, I sure would love to have your lifestyle. He goes, you couldn't handle it. And I'm like, yeah, I kind of figured that. But, you know, we did some stuff with him last year at JB's birthday bash at Virginia Motorsports Park, where Tyler Cross does that now with the Franklins. And he flew in, and he actually run it up at the race in Nitro Street, and that's essentially where we held our first Virginia-based 275 race, was at Virginia Motorsports Park in July of, I think, 2008. So, like, 10 years almost to the day, last July, Matt was runner-up, and I was runner-up at the first event as well. So that meant a lot to me, having him there and having him drive the car. and being a part of the program. And I get just as much joy working on the car and tuning for him and racing with him as I do actually behind the wheel of the car.
Yeah, and, you know, it's interesting how it all kind of comes full circle like that eventually. And, you know, it's kind of wild that you both did it almost same place, same time kind of deal for sure.
Yep. It's a good feeling. And I've got a lot of fond memories of my own race that I ran there. But then again, watching him do his thing too, it's just, you know, that right there, if I don't ever get a chance to race again, or be a part of another race, I don't think I can expect too much more out of life than what transpired.
Oh, for sure. That weekend. For sure. Well, John, our time here on the podcast is coming to an end, and I'd like to give all my guests one final chance to give shout-outs and let people know what's going on. So what can people, you know, where can they see John Sears and what's going on with John Sears this racing season?
Well, we are, like I said earlier, we're headed to Emerald Coast Dragway for the Mayhem on the Coast with Ryan and his crew down there at the Emerald Coast Dragway. So you can look for us online. I'm sure Ellen's going to be doing some live feed down there this weekend. After that, we will be at the prize fight, Ohio Valley in Kentucky, another points race down there. And we have a little bit of a hiatus until the Yellow Bullet event. Then Shakedown at Virginia Motorsports Park. It's got a new home. And then we'll be moving to No Mercy. And then I believe World Cup. And then we'll be closing out the year in Memphis. And then we'll see everybody at PRI. And if you need to get in touch with me, you can PM me on Facebook, John Laura Sears. Keep an eye on what we've got going on. Hopefully we'll have our own Malibu out sometime in July at JB's Bash running Nitro Street. No time. So really appreciate the time, Brian, and the opportunity to talk with everybody.
Awesome, John. Thanks for coming on the show. It was great to hear from you, and we'll look forward to seeing you out this year.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, that wraps up the show this week. Thanks for John for coming on and talk with us about all things 275 radio related. And as always, may your win lights be bright, your reaction times crisp. See you next week, folks.